Chapter 26 "Well, Kapitonich," said Seryozha, coming back rosy and cheerful from his walk the day before his birthday, and giving his overcoat to the tall old hall porter, who smiled down at the little fellow from the height of his long figure.
"Well, has the muffled-up man been here today? Did Papa see him?"
"He saw him. The minute the secretary came out, I announced him," said the hall porter with a good-humoured wink. "Here, I'll take it off." "Seryozha," said the tutor, stopping in the doorway leading to the inner rooms, "take it off yourself."
But Seryozha, though he heard his tutor's feeble voice, didn't pay attention to it. He stood, keeping hold of the hall porter's shoulder strap, and gazing into his face.
"Well, and did Papa do what he wanted?"
The hall porter nodded his head affirmatively. The muffled-up man, who had already been 7 times to ask some favour of Alexei Alexandrovitch, interested both Seryozha and the hall porter. Seryozha had come upon him in the hall, and had heard him plaintively beg the hall porter to announce him, saying that he and his children had death staring them in the face. Since then, Seryozha, having met him a second time in the hall, took great interest in him.
"Well, was he very glad?"
he asked.
"Glad? I should think so. Almost dancing as he went away."
"And has anything come?"
asked Seryozha, after a pause.
"Come, sir," said the hall porter. Then, with a shake of his head, he whispered, "Something from the Countess."
Seryozha understood at once that what the hall porter was speaking of was a present from the Countess Lydia Ivanovna for his birthday.
"You don't say! Where?"
"Corny took it to your papa. A fine thing it must be, too."
"How big? Like this?"
"Not quite, but a fine thing."
"A book?"
"No, a thing. Run along, run along. Vasily Lukitch is calling you," said the porter,
hearing the tutor's steps approaching, and carefully taking away from his shoulder strap the little hand and the glove half pulled off, he motioned with his head toward the tutor.
"Vasily Lukitch, in a tiny minute," answered Seryozha with that gay and loving smile which always won over the conscientious Vasily Lukitch.
Seryozha was too happy. Everything was too delightful for him to be able to help sharing with his friend, the porter, the family good fortune, of which he had heard during his walk in the public gardens from Lydia Ivanovna's niece. This piece of good news seemed to him particularly important, because it came at the same time with the happiness of the muffled-up official and his own happiness at a present having come for him. It seemed to Seryozha that this was a day on which everyone ought to be glad and happy.
"You know Papa's received the Alexander Nevsky today?"
"To be sure I do. People have been to congratulate him already."
"And is he glad?"
"Glad at the Tsar's favour? I should think so. It's proof he's deserved it," said the porter, sternly and seriously.
Seryozha became thoughtful, gazing up at the face of the porter, which he had thoroughly studied in every detail, especially the chin that hung down between the grey whiskers, never seen by anyone but Seryozha, who saw him only from below.
"Well, and has your daughter been to see you lately?"
The porter's daughter was a ballet dancer.
"When is she to come? On weekdays? They've their lessons to learn, too. And you've your lessons, sir. Run along."
On coming into the room, Seryozha, instead of sitting down to his lessons, told his tutor of his guess that what had been brought him must be a machine.
"What do you think?" he inquired.
But Vasily Lukitch was thinking of nothing but the necessity of learning the grammar lesson for the teacher who was coming at 2.
"No, do just tell me, Vasily Lukitch,"
he asked suddenly, when he was seated at the desk with the book in his hands.
"What is greater than the Alexander Nevsky?"
"You know Papa's received the Alexander Nevsky."
Vasily Lukitch replied that the Vladimir was greater than the Alexander Nevsky.
"And higher still?"
"Well, highest of all is the Andrei Pevozvani."
"And higher than the Andrei?"
"I don't know."
"What? You don't know?"
said Seryozha, leaning on his elbows, and he sank into deep meditation. His reflections were of the most complex and diverse character. He imagined his father's having suddenly been presented with both the Vladimir and the Andrei today, and in consequence being much kinder at his lesson, and dreamed how, when he was grown up, he would himself receive all the orders, and what they might invent higher than the Andrei. As soon as any higher order was invented, he would win it. They would make a higher one still, and he would immediately win that too. The time passed in such reflections, and when the teacher came, the lesson about the adverbs of place and time and manner of action wasn't ready, and the teacher wasn't only displeased, but hurt. This touched Seryozha. He felt he was not to blame for not having learned the lesson. However much he tried, he was utterly unable to do it. As long as the teacher was explaining to him, he believed him, and seemed to comprehend. But as soon as he was left alone, he was positively unable to recollect and to understand that the short and familiar word suddenly is an adverb of manner of action. Still, he was sorry that he had disappointed the teacher. He chose a moment when the teacher was looking in silence at the book.
"Mikhail Ivanich, when is your birthday?" he asked suddenly.
"You'll be much better thinking about your work. Birthdays are of no importance to a rational being. It's a day like any other on which one has to do one's work."
Seryozha looked intently at the teacher, at his scanty beard, at his spectacles which had slipped down below the ridge on his nose, and fell into so deep a reverie that he heard nothing of what the teacher was explaining to him. He knew that the teacher didn't believe what he said. He felt it from the tone in which it was said.
"But why have they all agreed to speak just in the same manner about the dreariest and most useless stuff? Why does he repulse me? Why doesn't he love me?" he asked himself mournfully, and couldn't think of an answer.
Chapter 27. After the lesson with the grammar teacher came his father's lesson. While waiting for his father, Seryozha sat at the table playing with a penknife and started thinking. Among Seryozha's favourite occupations was searching for his mother during his walks. He didn't believe in death generally, and in her death in particular, in spite of what Lydia Ivanovna had told him and his father had confirmed. And it was just because of that, after he had been told she was dead, that he had begun looking for her when out for a walk. Every woman of full, graceful figure with dark hair was his mother. At the sight of such a woman, such a feeling of tenderness was stirred within him that his breath failed him, and tears came into his eyes. And he expected that she would come up to him, would lift her veil. Her face would be visible, she would smile, she would hug him. He would smell her fragrance, feel the softness of her arms, and cry with happiness. Just as one evening he had lain on her lap while she tickled him, and he laughed and bit her white, ring-covered fingers. Later, when he accidentally learned from his old nurse that his mother wasn't dead, and his father and Lydia Ivanovna had explained that she was dead to him because she was wicked, which he couldn't possibly believe because he loved her, he went on seeking her and expecting her in the same way. That day in the summer garden there had been a lady in a lilac veil whom he had watched with a throbbing heart, believing it to be her as she came toward them along the path. The lady hadn't come up to them, but had disappeared somewhere. That day, more intensely than ever, Seryozha felt a rush of love for her, and now, waiting for his father, he forgot everything and notched the whole edge of the table with his penknife, staring straight before him with sparkling eyes and dreaming of her.
"Here is your papa," said Vasily Lukitch, rousing him.
Seryozha jumped up and went up to his father, and kissing his hand, he looked at him intently, trying to discover signs of his joy at receiving the Alexander Nevsky.
"Did you have a nice walk?" said Alexei Alexandrovitch, sitting down in his easy chair, pulling the volume of the Old Testament to him and opening it. Although Alexei Alexandrovitch had more than once told Seryozha that every Christian ought to know Scripture history thoroughly, he often referred to the Bible himself during the lessons, and Seryozha observed this.
"Yes, it was very nice, Papa," said Seryozha,
sitting sideways on his chair and rocking it, which was forbidden. I saw Nadenka. Nadenka was a niece of Lydia Ivanovna's, who was being brought up in her house.
She told me you'd been given a new star. Are you glad, Papa?
First of all, don't rock your chair, please, said Alexei Alexandrovitch. And secondly, it's not the reward that's precious, but the work itself. And I wish you'd understand that. Now, if you're going to work, to study in order to win a reward, then the work will seem hard to you. But when you work...
Alexei Alexandrovitch, as he spoke, thought of how he had been sustained by a sense of duty through the wearisome labour of the morning, consisting of signing 118 papers.
Loving your work, you will find your reward in it.
Seryozha's eyes, which had been shining with gaiety and tenderness, grew dull and drooped before his father's gaze. This was the same long, familiar tone his father always took with him, and Seryozha had learned by now to fall in with it. His father always talked to him, so Seryozha felt, as though he were addressing some boy of his own imagination, one of those boys who exist in books, utterly unlike himself. And Seryozha always tried, with his father, to act like the storybook boy.
"You understand that, I hope," said his father.
"Yes, Papa,"
answered Seryozha, acting the part of the imaginary boy. The lesson consisted of learning by heart several verses out of the Gospel, and the repetition of the beginning of the Old Testament. The verses from the Gospel Seryozha knew fairly well, but at the moment when he was saying them, he became so absorbed in watching a bone in his father's forehead that he lost the thread, and he transposed the end of one verse and the beginning of another. So it was evident to Alexei Alexandrovitch that Seryozha didn't understand what he was saying, and that irritated him. He frowned, and began explaining what Seryozha had heard many times before and never could remember, because he understood it too well, just as he understood that suddenly is an adverb of manner of action. Seryozha looked with frightened eyes at his father, and could think of nothing but whether his father would make him repeat what he had said, as he sometimes did. And this thought so alarmed Seryozha that now he understood nothing. But his father didn't make him repeat it, and passed on to the lesson out of the Old Testament. Seryozha recounted the events themselves well enough, but when he had to answer questions as to what certain events prefigured, he knew nothing, though he had already been punished over this lesson. The passage at which he was utterly unable to say anything, and began fidgeting and cutting the table and swinging his chair, was the one about the patriarchs before the flood. He didn't know one of them except Enoch, who'd been taken up alive to heaven. Last time he had remembered their names, but now he had forgotten them utterly, chiefly because Enoch was the character he liked best in the whole of the Old Testament, and Enoch's being taken to heaven was connected in his mind with the whole long train of thought, in which he became absorbed now, while he gazed with fascinated eyes at his father's watch chain and a half-unbuttoned button on his vest. In death, of which they talked to him so often, Seryozha disbelieved entirely. He didn't believe that those he loved could die, above all, that he himself would die. That was to him something utterly inconceivable and impossible. But he had been told that all men die. He had asked people, those whom he trusted, and they too had confirmed it. His old nurse, too, said the same, though reluctantly. But Enoch hadn't died, and so it followed that not everyone did die.
"And why cannot anyone else so serve God and be taken alive to heaven?" thought Seryozha.
"Bad people, that is, those Seryozha didn't like, they might die, but the good might all be like Enoch. Well, what are the names of the patriarchs?"
"Enoch? Enos?"
"But you've said that already. This is bad, Seryozha, very bad. If you don't try to learn what is more necessary than anything for a Christian," said his father, getting up. "Whatever can interest you. I'm displeased with you. And Pyotr Ignatych,
the most important of his teachers,
is displeased with you. I shall have to punish you."
His father and his teacher were both displeased with Seryozha, and he certainly did learn his lessons very badly. But still, it couldn't be said he was a stupid boy.
On the contrary,
He was far more clever than the boys his teacher held up as examples to him. In his father's opinion, he didn't want to learn what he was taught. In reality, he couldn't learn that. He couldn't, because the claims of his own soul were more binding on him than those claims his father and his teacher made upon him. Those claims were in opposition, and he was in direct conflict with his education. He was 9 years old. He was a child, but he knew his own soul. His teachers complained that he wouldn't learn, while his soul was brimming over with thirst for knowledge. And he learned from Kapitonich, from his nurse, from Nadenka, from Vasily Lukitch, but not from his teachers. The water his father and his teachers counted upon to turn their mill wheels had long since leaked out and did its work in another channel. His father punished Seryozha by not letting him go to see Nadenka, Lydia Ivanovna's niece, but this punishment turned out happily for Seryozha. Vasily Lukitch was in good humour and showed him how to make windmills. The whole evening passed in this work, and in dreaming of how to make a windmill on which he could turn himself, clutching at the sails or tying himself on and whirling around, Seryozha didn't think of his mother the whole evening. But when he had gone to bed, he suddenly remembered her and prayed in his own words that she would stop hiding herself and come to him tomorrow for his birthday.
"Vasily Lukitch, do you know what I prayed for extra?"
"That you might learn your lessons better."
"No." "Toys?" "No. You'll never guess. A splendid thing, but it's a secret. When it comes to pass, I'll tell you. Can't you guess?"
"No, I can't guess. You tell me," said Vasily Lukitch with a smile, which was rare for him. "Come, lie down. I'm putting out the candle."
"Without the candle, I can see better what I prayed for. There. I was almost telling the secret," said Seryozha, laughing gaily.
When the candle was taken away, Seryozha heard and felt his mother. She stood over him and with loving eyes caressed him. But then came windmills, a knife. Everything began to get mixed up, and he fell asleep. Chapter 28. On arriving in Petersburg, Vronsky and Anna stayed at one of the best hotels. Vronsky, alone on the lower floor, Anna above, with her child, her nurse, and her maid, in a large suite of 4 rooms. On the day of his arrival, Vronsky went to his brother's. There he found his mother, who had come from Moscow on business. His mother and sister-in-law greeted him as usual. They asked him about his stay abroad, and talked of their common acquaintances, but didn't let drop a single word about his liaison with Anna. His brother came the next morning to see him, and of his own accord asked him about her, and Vronsky told him frankly that he looked upon his union with Madame Karenina as marriage, that he hoped to arrange a divorce and then to marry her, and until then he considered her as much a wife as any other wife, and he begged him to tell their mother and his wife so.
"If the world disapproves, I don't care," said Vronsky. "But if my relatives want to be treated as such, they will have to act like relatives toward my wife."
The elder brother, who had always had a respect for his younger brother's judgment, couldn't quite tell whether he was right or not till the world had decided the question. For his part, he had nothing against it, and with Alexei, he went up to see Anna. Before his brother, as before everyone, Vronsky addressed Anna with a certain formality, treating her as he might a good friend. But it was understood that his brother knew their real relations, and they talked about Anna's going to Vronsky's estate. In spite of all his social experience, Vronsky was, in consequence of the new position in which he was placed, labouring under a strange delusion. One would have thought he must have understood that society was close to him and Anna, but now some vague ideas had sprung up in his brain that this was only the case in old-fashioned days, and that now, with the rapidity of modern progress, he had unconsciously become by now a partisan of every sort of progress, the views of society had changed, and that the question of whether they would be received in society was not a foregone conclusion.
"Of course," he thought, "she wouldn't be received at court, but intimate friends can and must look at it in the proper light."
One may sit for several hours at a stretch with one's legs crossed in the same position, if one knows that there's nothing to prevent one's changing one's position. But if a man knows that he must remain sitting so, with crossed legs, then cramps come on. The legs begin to twitch and to strain toward the spot to which one would like to draw them. This was what Vronsky was experiencing in regard to the world. Though at the bottom of his heart he knew that the world was shut to them, he put it to the test whether the world had not changed by now and wouldn't receive them. But he very quickly perceived that though the world was open for him personally, it was closed for Anna. Just as in the game of cat and mouse, the hands raised for him and were dropped to bar the way for Anna. One of the first ladies of Petersburg society whom Vronsky saw was his cousin Betsy. "At last," she greeted him joyfully. "And Anna? How glad I am. Where are you stopping? I can imagine that after your delightful travels you must find out poor Petersburg horrid. I can imagine your honeymoon in Rome. How about the divorce? Is that all over?" Vronsky noticed that Betsy's enthusiasm waned when she learned that no divorce had as yet taken place. "People will throw stones at me, I know," she said. "But I shall come and see Anna. Yes, I shall certainly come. You won't be here long, I suppose." And she certainly did come to see Anna the same day, but her tone was not at all the same as in former days. It was clear that she prided herself on her courage, and wished Anna to appreciate the fidelity of her friendship. She stayed only 10 minutes, talking of society gossip, and on leaving she said, "You never told me when the divorce is to be. I've flung convention to the wind, but others, straight-laced people, will give you the cold shoulder until you're married. And that's so simple nowadays. Ça se fait? So you're going on Friday. Sorry we shan't see each other again." From Betsy's tone, Vronsky might have grasped what he had to expect from the world, but he made another effort in his own family. His mother he didn't count upon. He knew that his mother, who'd been so enthusiastic over Anna at their first acquaintance, would have no mercy on her now for having ruined her son's career. But he had more hope of Varya, his brother's wife. He thought she would not cast stones, and would go simply and directly to see Anna, and would receive her in her own house. The day after his arrival, Vronsky went to her, and finding her alone, he expressed his wishes frankly. "You know, Alexei," she said after hearing him, "how fond I am of you, and how ready I am to do anything for you. But I haven't spoken, because I knew I could be of no use to you and Anna Arkadyevna," she said, articulating the name Anna Arkadyevna with particular care. "Don't suppose, please, that I judge her. Never, perhaps in her place, I would have done the same. I don't and can't enter into that," she said, glancing timidly at his gloomy face. "But one must call things by their names. You want me to go and see her, to ask her here, and to rehabilitate her in society. But do understand that I cannot do so. I have daughters growing up, and I must mix in society for my husband's sake. Well, I'm ready to come and see Anna Arkadyevna. She will understand that I can't ask her here, or I would have to do so in such a way that she would not meet people who look at things differently. That would offend her. I can't raise her."
"Oh, I don't regard her as more fallen than hundreds of women you do receive," Vronsky interrupted her, still more gloomily, and he got up in silence, understanding that his sister-in-law's decision was not to be shaken.
"Alexei, don't be angry with me. Please understand that I'm not to blame," Varya began, looking at him with a timid smile.
"I'm not angry with you," he said, just as gloomily. "But I'm sorry in two ways. I'm sorry, too, that this means breaking up our friendship. If not breaking up, at least weakening it. You will understand that for me, too, it cannot be otherwise."
And with that he left her. Vronsky knew that further efforts were useless, and that he had to spend these few days in Petersburg as though in a strange town, avoiding every sort of relation with his own old circle, in order not to be exposed to the annoyances and the humiliations which were intolerable to him. One of the most unpleasant features of his position in Petersburg was that Alexei Alexandrovitch and his name seemed to meet him everywhere. He couldn't begin to talk of anything without the conversation turning to Alexei Alexandrovitch. He couldn't go anywhere without risk of meeting him. So at least it seemed to Vronsky, just as it seems to a man with a sore finger that he is continually, as though on purpose, knocking his sore finger on everything. Their stay in Petersburg was the more painful to Vronsky because he perceived all the time a sort of new mood that he couldn't understand in Anna. At one time she would seem in love with him, and then she would become cold, irritable, and impenetrable. She was worrying about something, and keeping something back from him, and didn't seem to notice the humiliations which poisoned his existence, and for her, with her acute perception, must have been still more unbearable. Chapter 29. One of Anna's reasons for coming back to Russia had been to see her son. From the day she left Italy, the thought of it had never ceased to agitate her. And as she got nearer to Petersburg, the delight and importance of this meeting grew ever greater in her imagination. She didn't even put to herself the question of how to arrange it. It seemed to her natural and simple to see her son when she should be in the same town as he. But on her arrival in Petersburg, she was suddenly made distinctly aware of her present position in society, and she grasped the fact that to arrange this meeting was no easy matter. She had now been in Petersburg 2 days. The thought of her son never left her for a single instant, but she hadn't yet seen him. To go straight to the house where she might meet Alexei Alexandrovitch, she felt she had no right to do. She might be refused admittance and insulted. To write, and so enter into relations with her husband, that made her miserable to think of doing. She could be at peace only when she didn't think of her husband. To get a glimpse of her son out walking, finding out where and when he went out, was not enough for her. She had so looked forward to this meeting. She had so much she must say to him. She so longed to embrace him, to kiss him. Seryozha's old nurse might be a help to her, and show her what to do. But the nurse was no longer living in Alexei Alexandrovitch's house. In this uncertainty, and in efforts to find the nurse, 2 days had slipped by. Hearing of the intimate friendship between Alexei Alexandrovitch and Countess Lydia Ivanovna, Anna decided on the 3rd day to write her a letter, which cost her great pains, and in which she intentionally said that permission to see her son must depend on her husband's generosity. She knew that if the letter was shown to her husband, he would keep up his character of magnanimity and wouldn't refuse her request. The commissionaire who took the letter had brought her back the most cruel and unexpected answer, that there was no answer. She had never felt so humiliated as at the moment when, sending for the commissionaire, she had heard from him the exact account of how he had waited, and how afterwards he had been told that there was no answer. Anna felt humiliated, insulted, but she saw that from her point of view, Countess Lydia Ivanovna was right. Her suffering was the more poignant because she had to bear it in solitude. She couldn't and would not share it with Vronsky. She knew that to him, although he was the primary cause of her distress, the question of her seeing her son would seem a matter of very little consequence. She knew that he would never be capable of understanding the depth of her suffering, that for his cold tone at any allusion to it she would begin to hate him. And she dreaded that more than anything in the world. And so she hid from him everything that related to her son. Spending the whole day at home, she considered ways of seeing her son, and had reached a decision to write to her husband. She was just composing this letter, when she was handed the letter from Lydia Ivanovna. The Countess's silence had subdued and depressed her, but the letter, all that she read between the lines in it, so exasperated her. This malice was so revolting beside her passionate, legitimate tenderness for her son, that she turned against other people and stopped blaming herself. "This coldness, this pretense of feeling," she said to herself. "They only want to insult me and torture the child, and I am to submit to it. Not on any consideration. She's worse than I am. I don't lie, anyway." And she decided on the spot that next day, Seryozha's birthday, she would go straight to her husband's house, bribe or deceive the servants, but at any cost see her son and overturn the hideous deception with which they were surrounding the unfortunate child. She went to a toy shop, bought toys, and thought over a plan of action. She would go early in the morning, at 8 o'clock, when Alexei Alexandrovitch would be certain not to be up. She would have money in her hand to give the hall porter and the footman, so that they should let her in, and not raising her veil, she would say that she had come from Seryozha's godfather to congratulate him, and that she had been charged to leave the toys at his bedside. She had prepared everything but the words she would say to her son. Much as she thought of it, she couldn't prepare what to say. The next day, at 8 o'clock in the morning, Anna got out of a hired sleigh and rang at the front entrance of her former home.
"Run and see what's wanted. Some lady," said Kapitonich, who, not yet dressed in his overcoat and galoshes, had peeped out of the window and seen a lady in a veil standing close to the door.
His assistant, a lad Anna didn't know, had no sooner opened the door than she came in, and pulling a 3-ruble note out of her muff, put it hurriedly into his hand.
"Seryozha, Sergei Alexeyevich," she said, and walked in.
Scrutinizing the note, the porter's assistant stopped her at the second glass door.
"Whom do you want?" he asked.
She didn't hear his words, and made no answer. Noticing the embarrassment of the unknown lady, Kapitonich went to her, opened the second door for her, and asked her what she wanted.
"From Prince Skorodumov for Sergei Alexeyevich," she said.
"He's not up yet,"
said the porter, looking at her attentively. Anna had not anticipated that the absolutely unchanged hall of the house where she had lived for 9 years would so greatly affect her. Memories sweet and painful rose one after another in her heart, and for a moment she forgot what she was there for.
"Would you kindly wait?" said Kapitonich, taking off her fur cloak.
As he took off the cloak, Kapitonich glanced at her face, recognized her, and made her a low bow in silence.
"Please walk in, Your Excellency," he said to her.
She tried to say something, but her voice refused to utter any sound. With a guilty and imploring glance at the old man, she went with light, swift steps up the stairs. Bent double, and his galoshes catching in the steps, Kapitonich ran after her, trying to overtake her.
"The tutor's there. Maybe he's not dressed. I'll let him know."
Anna still mounted the familiar staircase, not understanding what the old man was saying.
"This way, to the left, if you please. Excuse its not being tidy. His honour's in the old parlour now," the hall porter said, panting. "Excuse me. Wait a minute, Your Excellency. I'll just see," he said.
And overtaking her, he opened the high door and disappeared behind it. Anna stood still, waiting.
"He's only just awake," said the hall porter, coming out.
And at the very instant the porter said this, Anna caught the sound of a childish yawn. From the sound of this yawn alone she knew her son, and seemed to see him living before her eyes.
"Let me in. Go away," she said,
and went in through the high doorway. On the right of the door stood a bed, and sitting up in the bed was the boy. His little body bent forward with his nightshirt unbuttoned. He was stretching and still yawning. The instant his lips came together, they curved into a blissfully sleepy smile, and with that smile he slowly and deliciously rolled back again.
"Seryozha,"
she whispered, going noiselessly up to him. During the time they had been separated, and more recently, when she'd been feeling a fresh rush of love for him, she had pictured him as he was at 4, when she had loved him most of all. Now he was not even the same as when she'd left him. He was still further from the 4-year-old baby, taller and thinner. How thin his face was! How short his hair was! What long hands! How he had changed since she had left him! But it was he, the shape of his head, his lips, his soft neck and broad little shoulders.
"Seryozha,"
she repeated, almost in the child's ear. He raised himself again on his elbow, turned his tousled head from side to side as though looking for something, and opened his eyes. Slowly and inquiringly he looked for several seconds at his mother standing motionless before him. Then all at once he smiled a blissful smile, and shutting his eyes, rolled not backward, but toward her into her arms.
"Seryozha, my darling boy," she said, breathing hard and putting her arms around his plump little body.
"Mama," he said, wriggling about in her arms so as to touch her arms with different parts of his body. Smiling sleepily, still with closed eyes, he flung his fat little arms around her shoulders, rolled towards her with the delicious, sleepy warmth and fragrance that is found only in children, and began rubbing his face against her neck and shoulders.
"I knew," he said, opening his eyes. "It's my birthday today. I knew you'd come. I'll get up now."
And saying that, he dropped back to sleep. Anna looked at him hungrily. She saw how he had grown and changed in her absence. She knew and didn't know the bare legs, so long now, that were thrust out below the blanket, and his cheeks, now thinner, those short curls on his neck where she had so often kissed him. She touched all this, and could say nothing. Tears choked her.
"What are you crying for, Mama?" he said, waking up completely. "Mama, what are you crying for?"
he cried in a tearful voice.
"I won't cry. I'm crying for joy. It's so long since I've seen you." "I won't. I won't," she said, gulping down her tears and turning away. "Come, it's time for you to dress now," she added after a pause.
And never letting go of his hands, she sat down by his bedside on the chair where his clothes were laid out for him.
"How do you dress without me? How..."
She tried to begin talking simply and cheerfully, but she couldn't. And again she turned away.
"I don't have a cold bath. Papa says I shouldn't. And you've not seen Vasily Lukitch? He'll come in soon. Why, you're sitting on my clothes!"
And Seryozha went off into a peal of laughter. She looked at him and smiled.
"Mama! Darling Mama!" he shouted,
flinging himself on her again and hugging her. It was as though only now, on seeing her smile, he fully grasped what had happened.
"You don't want that," he said, taking off her hat.
And as though seeing her afresh, he began kissing her again.
"But what did you think about me? You didn't think I was dead?" "I never believed it."
"You didn't believe it, my sweet?"
"I knew. I knew,"
he repeated his favourite phrase, and snatching the hand that was stroking his hair, he pressed the open palm to his mouth and kissed it. Chapter 30. Meanwhile, Vasily Lukitch had not at first understood who this lady was, but had learned from their conversation that it was no other person than the mother who had left her husband, and whom he had not seen since he had entered the house after her departure. He was in doubt whether to go in or not, or whether to communicate with Alexei Alexandrovitch. Reflecting finally that his duty was to get Seryozha up at the hour fixed, and that it was therefore not his business to consider who was there, the mother or anyone else, but simply to do his duty, he finished dressing, went to the door, and opened it. But the embraces of the mother and child, the sound of their voices and what they were saying, made him change his mind. He shook his head, and with a sigh he closed the door.
"I'll wait another 10 minutes," he said to himself, clearing his throat and wiping away tears.
Among the servants of the household there was intense excitement all this time. All had heard that their mistress had come, and that Kapitonich had let her in, and that she was even now in the nursery, and that their master always went in person to the nursery after 8, and everyone fully comprehended that it was impossible for the husband and wife to meet, and that they must prevent it. Corny, the valet, going down to the hall porter's room, asked who had let her in, and how it was he had done so. And learning that Kapitonich had admitted her and shown her up, he reprimanded the old man. The hall porter was doggedly silent, but when Corny told him he ought to be sent away, Kapitonich darted up to him, and waving his hands in Corny's face, he said, "Oh, yes, to be sure. You'd not have let her in. After 10 years' service, and never a word but of kindness,
And there you'd go up and say, "Get out of here." Oh, yes, you're a shrewd one, you are. You don't need to be taught how to swindle the master and to filch fur coats.
Boy, said Corney contemptuously, and he turned to the nurse who was coming in.
Here, what do you think, Maria Efimovna?
He let her in without a word to anyone, Corney said, addressing her. Alexei Alexandrovitch will be down immediately and go into the nursery.
A pretty business, a pretty business, said the nurse.
You, Corney Vasilievich, you'd best keep him some way or other, the master, while I run and get her away somehow. A pretty business.
When the nurse went into the nursery, Seryozha was telling his mother how he and Nadenka had had a fall while sledding downhill and had turned over 3 times. She was listening to the sound of his voice, watching his face and the play of expression on it, touching his hand, but she didn't follow what he was saying. She must go. She must leave him. This was the only thing she was thinking and feeling. She heard the steps of Vasily Lukitch coming up to the door and coughing. She heard, too, the steps of the nurse as she came near, but she sat like one turned to stone, incapable of speaking or getting up.
"Madam, dear madam," the nurse began, going up to Anna and kissing her hands and shoulders. "God has brought joy indeed to our boy on his birthday. You aren't changed one bit."
"Oh, nurse dear, I didn't know you were in the house," said Anna, rousing herself for a moment.
"I'm not living here. I'm living with my daughter. I came for the birthday, Anna Arkadyevna, my dear."
The nurse suddenly burst into tears and began kissing her hand again. Seryozha, with radiant eyes and smiles, holding his mother by one hand and his nurse by the other, jumped on the rug with his little bare feet. The tenderness shown by his beloved nurse to his mother threw him into ecstasy.
"Mama, she often comes to see me, and when she comes—" he was beginning.
But he stopped, noticing that the nurse was saying something in a whisper to his mother, and that in his mother's face there was a look of dread and something like shame which was so strangely unbecoming to her. She went up to him.
"My sweet," she said.
She couldn't say good-bye, but the expression on her face said it, and he understood.
"Darling, darling Kutik,"
she used the name she had called him when he was a baby.
"You won't forget me. You—"
But she couldn't say more. How often afterward she thought of words she might have said, but now she didn't know how to say it and could say nothing. But Seryozha knew all she wanted to say to him. He understood that she was unhappy and loved him. He understood even what the nurse had whispered. He had caught the words, "always after 8, and knew that this was said of his father, and that his father and mother couldn't meet. That he understood. But one thing he couldn't understand, why there should be a look of dread and shame in her face. She was not at fault, but she was afraid of him, and ashamed of something. He would have liked to put a question that would have set at rest this doubt, but he didn't dare. He saw that she was miserable, and he felt for her. Silently he pressed close to her and whispered, "Don't go yet. He won't come just yet." The mother held him away from her to see what he was thinking, what to say to him. And in his frightened face she read not only that he was speaking of his father, but, as it were, asking her what he ought to think about his father.
"Seryozha, my darling," she said, "love him. He's better and kinder than I am, and I have done him wrong. When you grow up, you will judge." "There's no one better than you," he cried in despair through his tears,
and clutching her by the shoulders, he began squeezing her with all his might to him, his arms trembling with the strain.
"My sweet, my little one," said Anna,
and she cried as weakly and childishly as he. At that moment the door opened. Vasily Lukitch came in. At the other door there was the sound of steps, and the nurse in a scared whisper said, "He's coming," and gave Anna her hat. Seryozha sank onto the bed and sobbed, hiding his face in his hands. Anna removed his hands, once more kissed his wet face, and with rapid steps went to the door. Alexei Alexandrovitch walked in, meeting her. Seeing her, he stopped short and bowed his head. Although she had just said he was better and kinder than she, in the rapid glance she flung at him, taking in his whole figure in all its details, feelings of revulsion and hatred for him, and jealousy over her son, took possession of her. With a swift gesture she put down her veil, and quickening her pace, almost ran out of the room. She hadn't time to unwrap them, and so carried back with her the parcel of toys she had chosen the day before in a toy shop, with such love and sorrow. Chapter 31 Intensely as Anna had longed to see her son, and much as she had been thinking of it and preparing herself for it, she had not in the least expected that seeing him would affect her so deeply. On getting back to her lonely rooms in the hotel, she couldn't for a long while understand why she was there. "Yes, it's all over, and I'm again alone," she said to herself. And without taking off her hat, she sat down in a low chair by the hearth. Fixing her eyes on a bronze clock standing on a table between the windows, she tried to think. The French maid, brought from abroad, came in to suggest she should dress. She gazed at her wonderingly and said, "Presently." A footman offered her coffee. "Later," she said. The Italian nurse, having dressed the baby, brought her to Anna. The plump, well-fed little baby, on seeing her mother, held out her fat little hands as she always did, so fat that they looked as if thread had been tightly tied around the wrists, and, with a smile on her toothless little mouth, began, like a fish waving its fins, beating the air, making the starched folds of her embroidered skirt rustle. It was impossible not to smile, not to kiss the baby, impossible not to hold out a finger for her to clutch, crowing with joy and wriggling all over, impossible not to offer her a lip which she sucked into her little mouth by way of a kiss. And all this Anna did, and took her in her arms and made her dance, and kissed her fresh little cheek and bare little elbows. But at the sight of this child, it was plainer than ever to her that the feelings she had for her could not be called love in comparison with what she felt for Seryozha. Everything about this baby was charming, but for some reason all this didn't penetrate deep to her heart. On her first child, though the child of an unloved father, had been concentrated all the love that had never found satisfaction. Her baby girl had been born in the most painful circumstances, and had not a hundredth part of the care and thought which had been concentrated on her first child. Besides, for the little girl, everything was still in the future, while Seryozha was by now almost a personality, and a personality dearly loved. In him there was a conflict of thought and feeling. He understood her. He loved her. He judged her, she thought, recalling his words and his eyes. And she was forever, not only physically but also spiritually, divided from him, and it was impossible to set this right. She gave the baby back to the nurse, let her go, and opened the locket in which there was Seryozha's portrait when he was almost the same age as the girl. She got up, and taking off her hat, took up from a little table an album in which there were photographs of her son at different ages. She wanted to compare them, and began taking them out of the album. She took them all out except one, the latest and best photograph. In it he was in a white smock, sitting astride a chair with frowning eyes and smiling lips. It was his best, most characteristic expression. With her deft little hands, her white, delicate fingers that moved with a peculiar intensity today, she pulled at a corner of the photograph, but the photograph had caught somewhere, and she couldn't get it out. There was no paper knife on the table, and so, pulling up the photograph that was next to her son's, it was a photograph of Vronsky, taken at Rome in a round hat and with long hair, she used it to push out her son's photograph. "Oh, here he is," she said, glancing at the portrait of Vronsky, and she suddenly recalled that he was the cause of her present misery. She hadn't once thought of him all morning, but now, coming all at once upon that manly, noble face, so familiar and so dear to her, she felt a sudden rush of love for him. "But where is he? How is it he leaves me alone in my misery?" she thought all at once with a feeling of reproach, forgetting she had herself kept from him everything concerning her son. She sent to ask him to come to her immediately. With a throbbing heart she awaited him, rehearsing to herself the words in which she would tell him all, and the expressions of love with which he would console her. The messenger returned with the answer that he had a visitor with him, but that he would come immediately, and that he asked whether she would let him bring with him Prince Yashvin, who had just arrived in Petersburg. "He's not coming alone, and since dinner yesterday he hasn't seen me," she thought. "He's not coming so that I could tell him everything, but coming with Yashvin." And all at once a strange idea came to her. What if he had ceased to love her? And going over the events of the last few days, it seemed to her that she saw in everything a confirmation of this terrible idea. The fact that he hadn't dined at home yesterday, and the fact that he had insisted on their taking separate sets of rooms at Petersburg, and that even now he wasn't coming to her alone, as though he were trying to avoid meeting her face to face. "But he ought to tell me. I must know that it is so. If I know it, then I'll know what I should do," she said to herself, utterly unable to picture to herself the position she would be in if she were convinced of his not caring for her. She thought he had ceased to love her. She felt close to despair, and consequently she felt exceptionally excited. She rang for her maid and went to her dressing-room. As she dressed, she took more care over her appearance than she had done all those days, as though he might, if he had grown cold to her, fall in love with her again because she had dressed and arranged her hair in the way most becoming to her. She heard the bell ring before she was ready. When she went into the drawing-room, it wasn't he but Yashvin who met her eyes. Vronsky was looking through the photographs of her son, which she had forgotten on the table, and he made no haste to look around at her. "We've met already," she said, putting her little hand into the huge hand of Yashvin, whose bashfulness was so strangely out of keeping with his powerful frame and coarse face. "We met last year at the races." "Give them to me," she said, with a rapid movement snatching from Vronsky the photographs of her son, and glancing significantly at him with flashing eyes. "Were the races good this year?" "Instead of them, I saw the races on the Corso in Rome." "But you don't care for life abroad," she said with a cordial smile. "I know you and all your tastes, though I've seen so little of you."
"I'm awfully sorry about that, for my tastes are mostly bad," said Yashvin, gnawing at his left moustache.
Having talked a little while, and noticing that Vronsky glanced at the clock, Yashvin asked her whether she would be staying much longer in Petersburg, and unbending his huge figure, he reached for his hat. "Not long, I think," she said hesitatingly, glancing at Vronsky.
"So then we shall not meet again?"
"Come and dine with me," said Anna resolutely, angry with herself for her embarrassment, but flushing as she always did when she defined her position before another person. "The dinner here isn't good, but at least you will see each other. There is not one of his old friends in the regiment Alexei cares for as he does for you."
"Delighted,"
said Yashvin with a smile, from which Vronsky could see that he liked Anna very much. Yashvin said good-bye and went away. Vronsky stayed behind. "Are you going too?" she said to him.
"I'm late already," he answered. "Run along. I'll catch up with you in a moment,"
he called to Yashvin. She took him by the hand, and without taking her eyes off him, gazed at him while she ransacked her mind for the words that would keep him. "Wait a minute, there's something I want to say to you," she said. And taking his broad hand, she pressed it on her neck. "Oh, was it right my asking him to dinner?"
"You did quite right," he said, with a serene smile that showed his even teeth,
and he kissed her hand. "Alexei, you haven't changed toward me," she said, pressing his hand in both of hers. "Alexei, I'm miserable here. When are we going away?"
"Soon. Soon. You wouldn't believe how disagreeable our way of living here is to me, too," he said.
And he drew away his hand. "Well, go. Go," she said, in a hurt tone, and she walked quickly away from him. Chapter 32. When Vronsky returned home, Anna was not yet home. Soon after he had left, some lady, so they told him, had come to see her, and she'd gone out with her. That she had gone out without leaving word where she was going, that she hadn't yet come back, and that all morning she'd been going about somewhere without a word to him, all this, together with the strange look of excitement in her face in the morning, and the recollection of the hostile tone with which she had almost snatched her son's photographs out of his hands in front of Yashvin, started him thinking. He decided he absolutely must speak frankly with her, and he waited for her in her drawing-room. But Anna didn't return alone. She brought with her her old unmarried aunt, Princess Oblonskaya. This was the lady who had come in the morning and with whom Anna had gone out shopping. Anna appeared not to notice Vronsky's worried and inquiring expression, and began a lively account of her morning's shopping. He saw that there was something going on within her. In her flashing eyes, when they rested for a moment on him, there was an intense concentration, and in her words and movements there was that nervous rapidity and grace which, during the early days of their intimacy, had so fascinated him, but which now disturbed and alarmed him. The dinner was laid for four. All were gathered together, and about to go into the little dining-room, when Tushkevich made his appearance with a message from Princess Betsy. Princess Betsy begged her to excuse her not having come to say good-bye, she had been indisposed, but begged Anna to come to her between 6:30 and 9 o'clock. Vronsky glanced at Anna because of the specific limit of time, which indicated that steps had been taken so that she should meet no one. But Anna appeared not to notice it. "Very sorry that I can't come just between 6:30 and 9:00, she said with a faint smile.
"The princess will be very sorry."
"And so am I."
"You're going, no doubt, to hear Patty," said Tushkevich.
"Patty? You suggest the idea to me. I would go if it were possible to get a box."
"I can get one," Tushkevich offered.
"I would be very, very grateful to you," said Anna. "But won't you dine with us?"
Vronsky gave a hardly perceptible shrug. He was at a complete loss to understand what Anna was doing. Why had she brought the old Princess Oblonskaya home? Why had she made Tushkevich stay to dinner? And most amazing of all, why was she sending him for a box? Could she possibly, in her position, think of going to Patty's benefit, where the entire circle of her acquaintances would be? He looked at her with searching eyes, but she responded with that defiant, half-mirthful, half-desperate look, the meaning of which he could not comprehend. At dinner, Anna was in aggressively high spirits. She almost flirted both with Tushkevich and with Yashvin. When they got up from dinner, and Tushkevich had gone to get a box at the opera, Yashvin went to smoke, and Vronsky went down with him to his own rooms. After sitting there for some time, he ran upstairs. Anna was already dressed in a low-necked gown of light silk and velvet that she had had made in Paris, with costly white lace on her head that framed her face and was particularly becoming, setting off her dazzling beauty.
"Are you really going to the theatre?" he said, trying not to look at her.
"Why do you ask with such alarm?" she said, wounded again at his not looking at her. "Why shouldn't I go?"
She appeared not to understand the motive of his words.
"Oh, of course there's no reason whatever," he said, frowning.
"That's just what I say,"
she said, wilfully refusing to see the irony of his tone, and quietly pulling up her long, perfumed glove.
"Anna, for God's sake, what's the matter with you?"
he said, appealing to her exactly as once her husband had done.
"I don't understand what you mean."
"You know it's out of the question to go."
"Why not? I'm not going alone. Princess Varvara, she's going with me."
He shrugged his shoulders with an air of perplexity and despair.
"But do you mean to say you don't know?"
he began.
"But I don't care to know," she shrieked. "I don't care to. Do I regret what I have done? No, no, no. If it were all to do again from the beginning, it would be the same. For us, for you, and for me. There's only one thing that matters, whether we love each other. Other people we need not consider.
Why are we living here apart and not seeing each other? Why can't I go? I love you, and nothing else matters, she said in Russian, glancing at him with a peculiar gleam in her eyes that he couldn't understand. If you have not changed toward me. Why don't you look at me? He looked at her. He saw all the beauty of her face and full evening dress, always so becoming to her. But now her beauty and elegance were just what irritated him. My feeling cannot change. You know. But I beg you, I entreat you, he said again in French, with a note of tender supplication in his voice, but with coldness in his eyes. She didn't hear his words, but she saw the coldness of his eyes and answered with irritation, And I beg you to explain why I shouldn't go.
Because it might cause you...
He hesitated. I don't understand.
Yashvin n'est pas compromettant,
and Princess Varvara is no worse than others.
Oh, here she is.
Chapter 33 Vronsky, for the first time, experienced a feeling of anger against Anna, almost hate, for her wilfully refusing to understand her own position. This feeling was aggravated by his being unable to tell her plainly the cause of his anger. If he had told her frankly what he was thinking, he would have said, In that dress, with a princess only too well known to everyone, to show yourself at the theatre is equivalent not merely to acknowledging your position as a fallen woman, but is flinging down the gauntlet to society, that is to say, cutting yourself off from it for ever. He couldn't say that to her. But how can she fail to see it? And what is going on in her mind? He said to himself. He felt at the same time that his respect for her was diminished, while his sense of her beauty was intensified. He went back scowling to his rooms, and sitting down beside Yashvin, who, with his long legs stretched out on a chair, was drinking brandy and club soda, he ordered a glass of the same for himself.
You were talking of Lankovsky's Powerful. That's a fine horse, and I would advise you to buy him, said Yashvin, glancing at his comrade's gloomy face. His hindquarters aren't quite first-rate, but the legs and the head, one couldn't wish for anything better.
I think I will take him, answered Vronsky.
Their conversation about horses interested him, but he didn't for an instant forget Anna, and couldn't help listening to the sound of steps in the corridor and looking at the clock on the mantelpiece.
Anna Arkadyevna gave orders to announce that she's gone to the theatre.
Yashvin, tipping another glass of brandy into the soda water, drank it and got up, buttoning his coat.
Well, let's go,
he said, faintly smiling under his moustache, and showing by this smile that he knew the cause of Vronsky's gloominess and didn't attach any significance to it.
I'm not going,
Vronsky answered gloomily.
Well, I must. I promise to. Goodbye, then. If you do, come to the stalls. You can take Krasinski's stall, he added as he went out.
No, I'm busy.
A wife is a worry, but it's worse when she's not a wife, thought Yashvin as he walked out of the hotel.
Vronsky, left alone, got up from his chair and began pacing up and down the room.
And what's today?
The fourth subscription night.
Yegor and his wife are there, and my mother, most likely. Of course all Petersburg's there. Now she's gone in, taken off her cloak, and come into the light.
He pictured them to himself.
What about me? Either that I'm frightened, or have given up to Tushkevich the right to protect her. From every point of view, stupid, stupid.
And why is she putting me in such a position? He said with a gesture of despair. With that gesture, he knocked against the table on which the soda water and the decanter of brandy were standing, and almost upset it. He tried to catch it, let it slip, and angrily kicked the table over and rang.
If you care to be in my service, he said to the valet who came in, you had better remember your duties. This shouldn't be here. You ought to have cleared it away.
The valet, conscious of his own innocence, would have defended himself, but glancing at his master, he saw from his face that the only thing to do was to be silent, and hurriedly threading his way in and out, he dropped down on the carpet and began gathering up the whole and broken glasses and bottles.
"That's not your duty. Send the waiter to clear it away, and get my dress suit out."
Vronsky went into the theatre at 8:30. The performance was in full swing. The little old box-keeper, recognizing Vronsky as he helped him off with his fur coat, called him "Your Excellency," and suggested he shouldn't take a number, but should simply call Fyodor when he wanted his coat. In the brightly lighted corridor there was no one but the box attendant and two footmen with fur cloaks on their arms, listening at the doors. Through the closed doors came the sounds of the discreet staccato accompaniment of the orchestra, and a single female voice rendering distinctly a musical phrase. The door opened to let an attendant slip through, and the phrase, drawing to a close, reached Vronsky's hearing clearly. But the doors were closed again at once, and Vronsky didn't hear the end of the phrase and the cadenza after it, though he knew from the thunder of applause that it was over. When he entered the theatre, brilliantly lighted with chandeliers and bronze gas brackets, the noise was still going on. On the stage, the prima donna, bowing and smiling, with bare shoulders flashing with diamonds, was, with the help of the tenor who had given her his arm, gathering up the bouquets that were flying awkwardly over the footlights. Then she went up to a gentleman with glossy, pomaded hair parted down the centre, who was stretching across the footlights, holding out something to her, and all the public in the stalls as well as in the boxes was in excitement, craning forward, shouting and clapping. The conductor, from his raised chair, assisted in passing the offering, and straightened his white tie. Vronsky walked into the middle of the stalls, and standing still, began looking about him. That day, less than ever, was his attention turned upon the familiar, habitual surroundings. The stage, the noise, all the familiar, uninteresting, multicoloured herd of spectators in the packed theatre. There were, as always, the same ladies, of some sort, with officers of some sort, in the back of the boxes, the same gaily dressed women, God knows who, and uniforms and black coats, the same dirty crowd in the upper gallery, and among the crowd, in the boxes and in the front rows, were some 40 of the real people. And to these oases Vronsky at once directed his attention and exchanged greetings with them. The act was over when he went in, and so he didn't go straight to his brother's box, but going up to the first row of stalls, stopped beside Serpukhovskoye, who, standing at the footlights with one knee raised, tapping the wall of the orchestra with his heel, caught sight of him in the distance and beckoned to him, smiling. Vronsky hadn't yet seen Anna. He purposely avoided looking in her direction. But he knew by the direction of people's eyes where she was. He looked around discreetly, but he wasn't seeking her. Expecting the worst, his eyes sought Alexei Alexandrovich Karenin. To his relief, Alexei Alexandrovich was not in the theatre that evening. "How little of the military man there is left in you," Serpukhovskoye was saying to him. "A diplomat, an artist, something of that sort, one would say." "Yes, as soon as I got home I put on a black coat," answered Vronsky, smiling, and slowly taking out his opera glasses.
"Well, I'll confess I envy you there. When I come back from abroad and put on this," he touched his epaulettes, "I regret my lost freedom."
Serpukhovskoye had long given up all hope of Vronsky's career, but he liked him as before, and was now particularly cordial to him.
"What a pity you weren't in time for the first act."
Vronsky, listening with one ear, moved his opera glasses from the stalls and scanned the boxes. Near a lady in a turban and a bald old man who seemed to blink angrily in the moving opera glasses, Vronsky suddenly caught sight of Anna's head, proud, strikingly beautiful, and smiling in the frame of lace. She was in the fifth box, 20 paces from him. She was sitting in front, and slightly turning, was saying something to Yashvin. The setting of her head on her beautiful, broad shoulders, and the restrained excitement and brilliance of her eyes and her whole face reminded him of her just as he had seen her at the ball in Moscow. But he felt utterly different toward her beauty now. In his feeling for her now, there was no element of mystery, and so her beauty, though it attracted him even more intensely than before, now offended him too. She wasn't looking in his direction, but Vronsky felt that she had seen him already. When Vronsky turned the opera glasses again in that direction, he noticed that Princess Varvara was particularly red in the face, and kept laughing unnaturally, and looking round at the next box. Anna, folding her fan and tapping it on the red plush of the next box, was looking away and didn't see, and obviously didn't wish to see what was taking place in the next box. Yashvin's face wore the expression that was common when he was losing at cards. Scowling, he sucked the left end of his moustache further and further into his mouth, and cast sidelong glances at the next box. In that box, on the left, were the Katasovs. Vronsky knew them, and knew that Anna was acquainted with them. Madame Katasova, a thin little woman, was standing up in her box, and her back turned to Anna, was putting on a mantle that her husband was holding for her. Her face was pale and angry, and she was talking excitedly. Katasov, a fat, bald man, was continually looking round at Anna while attempting to soothe his wife. When the wife had gone out, the husband lingered a long while and tried to catch Anna's eye, obviously anxious to bow to her. But Anna, with unmistakable intention, avoided noticing him and talked to Yashvin, whose cropped head was bent down to her. Katasov went out without making his salutation, and the box was left empty. Vronsky couldn't understand exactly what had passed between the Katasovs and Anna, but he was certain that something humiliating for Anna had happened. He knew this both from what he had seen, and most of all from the face of Anna, who, he could see, was taxing every nerve to carry through the role she had undertaken. And in maintaining this attitude of external composure, she was completely successful. Anyone who didn't know her and her circle, who had not heard all the utterances of the women expressive of commiseration, indignation, and amazement that she should show herself in society, and show herself so conspicuously with her lace and her beauty, would have admired the serenity and loveliness of this woman without a suspicion that she was undergoing the sensations of someone in the stocks. Knowing that something had happened, but not knowing precisely what, Vronsky felt a thrill of painful agitation, and hoping to find out something, he went toward his brother's box. Purposely choosing the way round furthest from Anna's box, he ran into the colonel of his old regiment talking to two acquaintances. Vronsky heard the name of Madame Karenina, and noticed how the colonel hastened to address Vronsky loudly by name, with a meaningful glance at his companions.
"Ah, Vronsky! When are you coming to the regiment? We can't let you off without a supper. You're one of the old set," said the colonel of his regiment. "I can't stop. Very sorry. Another time," said Vronsky, and he ran upstairs toward his brother's box.
Varya, with the young Princess Sorokina, met him in the corridor. Leaving the Princess Sorokina with her mother, Varya held out her hand to her brother-in-law, and began immediately to speak of what interested him. She was more excited than he had ever seen her.
"I think it's mean and hateful. A Madame Katasova had no right to do it."
"Madame Karenina," she began.
"But what is it?"
"I don't know." "What? You've not heard?"
"You know I would be the last person to hear of it."
"There isn't a more spiteful creature than that Madame Katasova."
"But what did she do?"
"My husband told me. She has insulted Madame Karenina." Her husband began talking to her across the box, and Madame Katasova made a scene. She said something aloud, he says, something insulting, and went away. "Count, your maman is asking for you," said the young Princess Sorokina, peeping out of the door of the box.
"I've been expecting you all the while," said his mother, smiling sarcastically. "You were nowhere to be seen."
Her son saw that she couldn't suppress a smile of delight.
"Good evening, Maman. I was coming to you," he said coldly.
"Why aren't you going to faire la cour à Madame Karenina?" she went on, when Princess Sorokina had moved away. "Elle fait sensation. On oublie la pâté pour elle."
"Maman,
"I've asked you not to say anything to me of that," he answered, scowling. "I'm only saying what everyone's saying."
Vronsky made no reply, and saying a few words to Princess Sorokina, he left. At the door he met his brother.
"Ah, Alexei," said his brother, "how disgusting! Idiot of a woman! Nothing else! I wanted to go straight to her. Let's go together."
Vronsky didn't hear him. With rapid steps he went downstairs. He felt that he must do something, but he didn't know what. Anger with her for having put herself and him in such a false position, together with pity for her suffering, filled his heart. He went down and made straight for Anna's box. At her box stood Stremov, talking to her.
"There are no more tenors. Le moulin est brise."
Vronsky bowed to her and stopped to greet Stremov.
"You came in late, I think, and have missed the best aria," Anna said to Vronsky, glancing ironically, he thought, at him.
"I'm a poor judge of music," he said, looking sternly at her.
"Like Prince Yashvin," she said, smiling, "who maintains that Patti sings too loud."
"Thank you," she said, her little hand in its long glove taking the playbill Vronsky picked up. And suddenly, at that instant, her lovely face quivered. She got up and went into the interior of the box. Noticing in the next act that her box was empty, Vronsky, rousing murmurs of "hush" from the audience, which had grown quiet as a cavatina began, left the orchestra and drove home. Anna was already at home. When Vronsky went up to her, she was in the same dress she had worn at the theatre. She was sitting in the first armchair against the wall, looking straight before her. She looked at him, and at once resumed her former position.
"Anna," he said.
You
are to blame for everything," she cried, with tears of despair and anger in her voice, getting up. "I begged, I implored you not to go. I knew it would be unpleasant."
"Unpleasant," she cried. "Hideous. As long as I live, I shall never forget it. She said it was a disgrace to sit beside me."
"A silly woman's chatter," he said. "But why risk it? Why provoke?"
"I hate your calm. You shouldn't have brought me to this. If you had loved me..."
"Anna, how does the question of my love come in?"
"Oh, if you loved me as I love. If you were tortured as I am," she said, looking at him with an expression of terror. He was sorry for her, and angry all the same. He assured her of his love, because he saw that this was the only means of soothing her, and he didn't reproach her in words, but in his heart he reproached her. And the assurances of his love, which seemed to him so vulgar that he was ashamed to utter them, she drank in eagerly, and gradually became calmer. The next day, completely reconciled, they left for the country.